So hi, I'm Bruce McLeod, and welcome back to TestCast. This is show number 4. We're still kicking around, Trish.
Yeah, we're still here. Are you still here?
Why are you listening to us? A couple of little stories to tell. Hopefully the audio on this show is a bit better than the first two shows.
Technical difficulties.
Well, yeah, someone didn't turn the right mic on.
It wasn't me.
And the levels were very, very low. And thanks to the magic of software, managed to actually recover a show, hopefully.
He says to himself, checking and seeing, yes, it is recording.
Managed to pull one out of the bag. So apologies if the audio quality was crap. Second thing I need to apologise for is I do tend to speak a bit quickly.
Really?
It's, yeah.
I hadn't noticed.
I used to mumble as well and talk and mumble and talk and mumble and liquid. So, yeah. So, I've tried to tell you, unfortunately, who I am. If I was being really arrogant, I'd say there's a half speed button on the iPod, but I won't do that because that's just not being nice.
Yeah.
So I've been playing a little bit in Ruby on Rails since we last spoke. And it's very interesting to go to that different way of thinking where you're back in the text editor.
Yeah.
The text run to error, text run error. It's, to be honest, I would have thought my productivity in that environment would be a lot worse from not having the IDE support, because I've sort of learnt, been using Visual Studio for years and have come to really appreciate it. But what I think, what I found interesting is that the community behind Ruby, and I assume that this is true not just for Ruby on Rails, but also for Water and the whole Ruby scripting with testing and that sort of things. I went to that as a barrier to entry, not wanting to learn another language, but I think having really good community support in that sort of stuff, I think, makes a huge difference.
Oh, it so does, yeah. I've been trying to learn Ruby as well, and I haven't quite got to Rails yet, but I've learned a fair bit of Ruby, and, yeah, just the resources out there because of the community just makes such a huge difference. So much easier to learn that way.
Yeah, so it's so then I sort of a little bit thing on Cucumber, and I didn't go into it yet, so, I've just stayed away from, I've been in dev mode, so.
What text editor are you using?
I'm using on the Mac, using TextMate.
TextMate, okay.
Which is the Ruby editor du jour. It just happens that it's a really good editor. I've been using it, yeah.
Oh, yeah, so. Haven't gone on to Vim? Not a Vim fan.
Okay, do we really want to get, we're getting away from testing here, but it's like, okay. First thing, are you a VI person or an Emacs person? Now, the fact that you say Vim and not VI, you're new school, you're not old school.
No, okay.
Yeah, because Vim is, you know, it's not the original
it's
VI.
It's improved. Yeah. It's better.
No, I grew up. my introduction to Unix was back in 1991 on a digital deck Ultrix system where email was just Elm. It was all command line. So everything was, there was no GUI, there was no, and I remember my wife, she started to, she said, oh, the web. And I'm like, web? What's this web? That's not the internet. The internet's green screen. And so everything, so I learnt to program in VI, where that's all we had was VI, CC, and wasn't even GNU debugger, it was just the equivalent of DBG. That was it. That's how I learnt.
That's all good. I'm just antagonizing you. Go on with your Ruby story.
It's painful. So I think I actually thought Ruby was always a bit of an impediment to actually using those things. I was completely wrong on that. I haven't tried Selenium or any of those things in Ruby or Water. I might do, because I actually would like to maybe at some point. But right now I'm actually building a test management system.
No, really?
It's an itch I've just been meaning to scratch. So here's the thing, right? If you're a testing vendor, there's some fundamental things that a test management system has to do. And I don't think any of them do it well.
Yeah.
Point one, you have to be accessible and cheap.
Yes, yes.
Right, that's fundamental. That's just a huge thing with me is whenever I try and roll out testing process, no matter, even though you might be an organization with huge budget or small budget, as soon as you have to go to someone and say, can I have insert dollar value here, anywhere from $1,000 on a small organization to you could be talking $100,000 or $1 million investment over a large organization, those conversations are always never fun.
Yeah.
Always an impediment.
Definitely.
So I think this is part of the rise of the open source, right?
Yeah.
So, and I suppose having worked on open source for a while, having converted, I suppose the last time I really used commercial tools in anger was CompuWare Test Partner, probably 5 or 6 years ago. I'm not saying they don't have their role, they definitely, their place, they definitely do, but I personally have found, for me, open source is much better.
Yeah, same.
And the reason why, part of the reason why I made that jump was we actually had browser crashes at the time, and we were paying for CompuWare support, and they were really, really good with who we were. They actually flew an engineer. She flew out from the US, was on site. She thought she'd be there for 2 days to fix these browser crashes. She was there for 3.5 weeks. I think we were 7 different IE crashes that we were causing. Wow. She managed to solve 3 of them.
Right.
And then, so we just sort of, from then we moved on. So I suppose this is what I found interesting, is that with test tool vendors, one of the big reasons to pay for is that support. That's one of the main reasons it's one of the main reasons why I would choose a QTP or a Microsoft. The reason why you choose a vendor is for the support. So if you've got a problem, you can pick up the phone and get the support. In this situation, that showed, for me personally anyway, that even though that support came, it couldn't solve our problem. So I suppose the question is, and particularly if you're real blue, if you are going to pay for a commercial vendor, is the value there, and are they going to be a bulldog and just solve that problem for you? And I think most good vendors will do that for you.
Yeah.
And so that's one really good reason to not go open source. If you're prepared, if that's one thing that you want, that's a really good reason. And that, for a lot of organizations, that completely justifies the spend.
Yeah, sure.
But as a tester personally, I don't want, if I can avoid having that whole discussion of, can you please buy me the tool? I can just get in and do it.
Yeah.
I find that to be better. So I can't do that with test management tools. Like there's TestLink, just look at, so, okay, point one is accessible. I'll come back to it. The second thing is, has the entire testing industry been asleep while Web 2.0 has happened?
What the hell?
Like, have a look at your iPhone. Have a look at, I don't know, products from 37 Signals.
Quality, usability, design.
It's like, have a look at any modern web application. Google, anything from Google. Any application from Google.
Yeah.
Look at it and go, my testing tool should be like this.
Yeah. Something that's nice to use.
So, Ajax, HTML5 jQuery, or let's use some of these modern technologies and not be stuck in the dark ages. So there's that.
Yeah, definitely.
My iPad. I wanted to work on my iPad.
Why? Oh, reports.
Well, reports, or just, but as a client, I just want to, like, I want it to be just a, if it's going to be a web app, it's got to be a web app.
Yeah.
It's not going to be it's web, but I have to load this custom browser and download this control.
Yeah, definitely. Like, oh my God, cross-browser compatibility, people.
The rise of Apple, Macs are on the rise, it's 26% increase, everything else is going down. Web-based is web-based, right? So just those three boxes: accessible, modern, and actual true. So like
wait, and not buggy.
Oh, come on, Trish.
It's a testing tool. There are so many that are buggy. It's ridiculous.
Come on, you don't expect the domain of a testing tool to actually be used in the domain that it's actually targeting.
Yeah, use your testing tool to test your testing tool.
Yeah, agree with that. So that's my guide, and so I'm sick of not having it, so I just fired up Ruby on Rails and started building it.
Oh, good stuff. When's your ship date?
I don't know.
Oh.
Well, to be honest, I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know whether I'm going to open source it or make a commercial. I just don't know. I don't even know what I can do, to be honest. It's just one of those things where I'm just, if nothing else, I've got to prove, be able to prove this to people and be able to put it in front of people and go, see? Look, see? And here it is. The domain's not that hard. You have a test, you have a test case, you have a test result. Each of those has about four fields. It's like one of the simpler, like bug tracking, right?
Yeah.
It's a bug. It has a state.
Yeah.
It has attachments.
Come on.
And it's like a mutual requirement. It's not, the domain isn't that hard. It's not like you're building an air traffic control system.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, geez. Oh. So.
Set a new standard.
Yeah. So, testers, rise up. Build a test management tool, make it open source, or make it commercial at a reasonable price. Like, I think Atlassian, look, I haven't really used Jira and Angular. I hear a lot of good things about it.
Yeah.
But I think that's the sort of pricing model that they have, the for Jira. That's the sort of thing, I think, which is...
Seems like the most reasonable...
$10 for 10 users.
Yeah.
There's no barrier to entry.
Yeah, and the scales up accordingly for more users.
So if you are a large corporate, you can buy that support and you can get what you need.
I did see, I did find a testing tool once that was, it looked really nice, it was quite easy to use. I don't know, it seemed a bit limited in functionality, and the pricing was okay as well, but then the problem was it wasn't scalable.
Yeah.
I tried to put 1,000 test cases in there and it just crashed on me. So
once again, testing, not testing the testing tool.
Quality.
Yeah. So I'm sure we'll probably get a barrage of emails and people say, oh, there are these good tools, but there's no standout.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yes, there's definitely pockets of a little from unknown company X or unknown company Y, but I suppose if the best shining star of an open source test management tool that we have is TestLink.
Yeah.
We're in trouble.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll say.
So, you know, I might open source it. But again, I'm mainly doing it like for anything. It's a personal thing that I just wanted to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, who knows? God, there might be even patents in this area that we've stopped me from doing it.
Yeah. But, I made some grand plans for my own test management tool. But I don't think I'm going to build it. I don't have enough time and I don't think I'm a good enough developer to do it, quite frankly.
Well, I suppose there is part of that too, isn't there? There's the whole if testers are good enough devs to write testing tools, then why aren't they devs?
Yeah.
I suppose there is part of
that. I guess there's a bit of that, yeah.
But then again, I don't know if I agree with that, because
I know testers who are perfectly good developers.
If you look at the... I don't agree with my own statement. if you look at the... What am I going to say? If you look at the amount of emphasis and effort that's gone on behind WebDriver and Watton and Water and... So for these GUI, open source GUI automation tools, there's a ton of people contributing some small to those projects. And to be honest, those are a lot more complicated than a test management tool.
Yeah, definitely.
GUI automation is pretty damn hard.
Yeah, to
do,
for sure.
And do well and do properly. And there's a ton of people that are doing and contributing to that.
Yeah.
So, come on, test management tool, let's do it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
FullView is a boutique design studio that fuses creativity with strategy to create effective graphic design for web and print. To find out more about their work and services, go to www.ful-vue.com.
You can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Technologica, TEKNOLOGIKA, and Trish is at Hogfish.
Yes.
Where did this Hogfish come from, Trish?
Oh my gosh. Well, I guess it all started when I made up my own religion in grade 9.
What? You made up your own religion?
Yeah. I don't know. It seemed like a good idea at the time. We've got about 20 members, and it was basically based around the idea that we wanted every single day to be a holiday. So I started making up these cultural holidays for ourselves, and I made a website for it. I think I've taken it down now. It was the religion of it, And then at some point everybody thought it was the religion of IT, which coincidentally ended up being my career path, so everybody thought I was just being nerdy. But no, that was a coincidence, actually. Anyway, how this ties into the Hogfish thing is that my name in this religion was Lord Hogfish, which is a bit gender confusing, so I sort of did away with that. I don't know. I was on some sort of feminist
push at the time.
I don't really know what the logic was behind that. I went to an all-girls school, all right? It made sense at the time.
Right.
Yeah, so I'm sure that clears all that up.
So, Technologica, in case you're wondering, this comes from when I ran my own small support business and the need to try and find a .com domain name.
Uh-huh.
So, the idea was technical logic.
Yeah.
Put it together.
And then spell it wrong.
And then spell it wrong so you can actually get a .com domain name. So change the tech and logica to T-E-K, you know, technologica. And so then, I haven't done it at the company anymore, but that sort of seems to now become the personal brand.
Yeah. Oh, you'd be surprised to know that hogfish.net was already available.
Funny that. So, yeah, so what's interesting, though, is over the years I have had a couple of pings of, hey, I've got a company called Technologica. Can I buy your domain name? No. No, sorry. Not going to happen. So it's gone from there. And it's quite interesting. So because I had a company that was called Technologica, I've got company shirts made up.
Really?
I've got a logo for the company. Uh-huh. So therefore I called the last boat that I made was also called Technologica.
Really?
So,
aren't you supposed to name them after women as some sort of good luck thing?
No.
Oh, I thought that was a seafaring thing.
No.
I've been lied to.
You've definitely been lied to. So, Trish.
Yes.
On domain names. Little bit of testing trivia.
Uh-huh.
If you were going to test a domain name.
Yes.
What would you test? So, for example, testing up a... Okay, here's a test case for you. Let's say, for example, I don't know, you are a tester, a campaign monitor.
Ah.
And you've got a login form where new people can sign up.
Yes.
And you're collecting emails.
Uh-huh.
What sort of test cases would you apply to those emails? What is a valid email or not?
Oh, a valid email. Okay. See, somebody asked me this recently. I'll tell you what I do is I kind of end up cheating and I go into the production database, grab a whole heap of valid emails out of the production database, of which there are plenty, and then I plug them into the test system, as long as they don't actually get emailed, because that would be horrendous, and I just make sure that all of them pass.
So my kick. Production data.
Yeah.
Test data. Excellent. I'll come back to that.
Well, this is on top of my other input testing, of course.
I want to come back to the use of production data for testing. I definitely want to come back to that.
All right.
I didn't talk to that. So, but back to this, the testing of a form. So, what is a valid email if you're using production data? So,
I didn't answer your question, but anyway.
Okay, so me being me,
I'd
straight away go, if I'm trying to find bugs. So the first thing I'll do is I'll just fire up my computer.
See, this is my lazy approach to finding bugs. I write a script, I set it running,
and I'm going to find some tester bugs here.
Are you going to start putting things in foreign languages?
Yes, well, sort of. So do you know what I mean when I say a tester bug?
Yeah, they're the bugs that you find where the developer is going to go, no user's ever going to do that, only you are ever going to do that.
I love tester bugs.
Oh, me too.
So, for example, I have in here in front of me RFC... Oh, that's not it. That's the wrong RFC. Email. There we go. Here it is. RFC 2822 Internet Message Format. Which is the RFC for what is a valid email addresses.
That's very excellent.
So, let me have a look at this. And you'll see... I think I did this once.
It's quite lengthy, isn't it?
It's ridiculously lengthy.
There are a whole heap of email addresses that actually are valid in the true sense of the RFC email address.
Yep.
That are not. So, for example, certain characters that are valid in email addresses via the RFC. So an email may be any ASCII character. It may have digits 0 to 9. It may also have exclamation marks, hashes, dollar signs, percent signs, ands, tilde star, plus minus divide, question mark, carré, underscores, dashes, open bracket, pipe, and close bracket.
Yep.
With curly brackets. They're all valid email address characters.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I can guarantee a lot of systems just won't accept those.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, it's a valid. The RFC says it's a valid email address. But you don't accept it.
Oh, yeah, that would be a bug.
But it's not, because I've raised both and I've gone, Bruce, no one has a curly brace in their email address.
Well, that's just it, really. I think I would get a response along the lines of, you know, in the amount of years that we've been running this, nobody's ever complained that they haven't been able to put in email addresses with the curly braces in it, so we're not going to waste time on it now.
Okay, another question. Domain names. So,
yes.
If you're searching for a domain name, yeah. What's a valid domain name?
What's a valid domain name? You know, I don't know. I'd have to look up the internet for that kind of thing.
Look up the internet. Well,
I know that. I know off the top of my head that domain names have to be of a certain structure, and that there was some kind of talk recently about being able to use all sorts of foreign characters and other characters in the domain name, which got some testers kind of agitated.
Yeah.
And some developers probably even more agitated.
So what's interesting is that you have for a while been able to use non-English domain names.
Yeah, it actually has been for a while, hey.
So this, your example here, and I'm on Wikipedia, and there'll be a link in the show notes. So this domain name here is in Japanese.
Ah, what does that say? Tesudo, main page. Yeah, test main page. No, I'm serious.
I know you can read it. But isn't that a whole world of test awesome? How many systems? Let's have a test, shall we?
Hey.
Let's sign up. What service do we want to sign up for? New.
Oh, boy.
Campaign.
Yeah, I don't know if we support that. We probably do.
Campaign monitor. Camping monitor. No.
Yeah, that's a different kind of service.
Yeah.
And you've spelled that wrong again.
Oh, better yet. Okay.
Campaign monitor.
Let's sign up for the testcast.net mail.
Let's do that. Do we even have any validation in that?
So we're heading over to testcast.net and we're going to put in
testcast
show 4.
Oh, you're going to put it as the domain name
for the email. I wish I could spell.
Testumenopage. Well, that's because you have an HTTP something something in front of it. Right?
Oh. Ye of details.
Well, it's because...
Bubble.
You know.
Completely expected. But
yeah.
So, there's two parts. This one is...
Yeah, no issue.
But also, to be honest, it's one of these edge cases that... And it's like if you use Opera.
Yeah.
On the internet, right?
Using Opera is an edge case.
Or IE6 now. You're going to be used to having things broken.
Wait, are you saying if you're Japanese, you're used to having things broken?
I'm saying if your only domain name and your only email address
yeah.
is a pure Japanese internet address with no normal equivalent, better get used to typing in the IP numbers.
Yeah, true. Well, if you're going to non-Japanese websites anyway.
True, absolutely. So, Trish.
Yeah.
This is an invalid email address. I'm supposed to campaign monitor.
There you go.
Tell me, testing email.
Yep.
How do you test something like an email system? What are the sort of things that you do?
Well, for one thing, we have to generate a whole lot of large lists of email subscribers, because what our system does is it's primarily used for emailing large amounts of subscribers. So ultimately, sometimes I'll want all of those emails to go to my inbox so that I can actually read them all, or at least some sort of inbox accessible by me. And sometimes I don't want them all to come to my inbox, because Gmail doesn't like it when you send yourself 6 million emails, as it turns out, that I found out the hard way. There's some interesting things, actually, but...
So you're actually using a third party. You don't have your own internal email servers, that you just do it all internally on your own network. You actually use...
What I usually do is I've got a Gmail account set up. So if I'm going to test out something where I want to actually see the emails, I'll just do a small send to myself, or a large send with a couple of my email addresses added to the subscriber list. And so I'll probably only send myself about 20 to 40 emails at a time.
So email addresses, so how many accounts do you have? Do you set up 50 different accounts that you use?
No, I have one.
One?
Because with...
Explain this black magic.
Because with Gmail, you see, you can add a plus sign to the end of your address. So if my email address is something like trish@campaignmonitor.com, which it isn't, by the way, just in case anybody... Anyway, I could go trish+1@campaignmonitor.com, and it would go to the same account, assuming it's a Gmail account, which, you know, I'm... in my hypothetical campaign monitor world, would redirect to one. That's what I usually do. I set up a list with TrishK+1, TrishK+2, etc., etc., etc. Or TrishK+, insert funny characters here. And it'll all end up in my inbox. What I do when I want to send to a much bigger list is we've got an internal domain set up which redirects all of the emails to... some kind of black hole that just sucks it into nothingness.
So
it doesn't put a whole lot of strain on our servers. Nothing's trying to catch it all. It'll just throw it away. I think we've set it up as something like blackhole.com or something like that. And then we've got a couple of email addresses set up to do certain things like simulate a spam request. In Gmail or other systems, they'll have a button now that says, mark this as spam, I don't want this anymore, kind of thing. So we've got something that will simulate that kind of process on our end. And we can send to an email address that will simulate that. We've also got one for bounces in case we want to simulate some kind of bounce. So
in testing email, how much of your do you rely on normal clients, and how often, if at all, do you have to actually go in and look at the actual mail bodies or headers, and like to actually go into the actual the magic hidden stuff on email? So do you ever find the need to go in there? Are you really looking at the look and feel of
email? It depends on what we're doing. So if we're doing massive changes to things that will affect the body of the email, then we will need to go and have a look at the source code for the HTML email. Another thing that we do is we'll usually send out an HTML version and a plain text version as well. And some email clients, even if you say view as plain text, it's not really showing you the actual plain text that's sent out separately. Just sending you a plain text representation of that HTML email. It's just converted it. So you're not really testing the actual plain text in that sense. So if you use something like Mozilla Thunderbird, then there's an option to view the plain text version of that. Sometimes we do have to look at this at the body of the email, mainly to test things like make sure that images served from the CDN are working properly, getting served from the right domains, links are well formed, that kind of thing.
So one of the big landmark features that I suppose Campaign Monitor has launched recently has been Worldview.
Yes.
Awesome feature.
Thank you.
How the heck do you even contemplate testing something like that? Obviously heavily manual because of just the nature of
what's
done. But so for something where you've got geolocation,
part
of what sort of approach have you?
Well, you know,
did you go everywhere in the world and send them to yourself? And
you know, it's interesting you ask that because I put that as the question on a senior test analyst job ad as sort of a screening question, right? So, I don't know. First of all, I'd ask you, how do you think we tested?
Here we go. We covered interviews in the last show. How was it?
But I'm interested to know. So what is this?
Is this every 2 weeks we sit down and do a show and it's like, welcome to job interview?
Yeah, well, but you know, at the moment, I'm just asking you how I should do my job.
All right, let me have a think about this. All right, so, okay. So, let me think about this. Cue thinking music.
Yes, thinking. See, this is it. This is where a few candidates went wrong.
Cue thinking music. Okay. So my assumptions are going to. I'm going to come back with a few relevant assumptions, questions in a minute before I actually answer your question. So, obviously, there needs to be somehow some sort of response coming back from the client who's opening the email.
Yes.
And that somehow has to have the geolocation code in it.
Yep.
I need to understand it or make some assumptions on how that's working. So I'm assuming that if that is based on IP address, then you're somehow getting back when someone opens an email. There's some magic of software.
Yeah.
There's a magical piece of software that is somehow getting back to your servers the IP address, and then from that location is being derived via geocoding service.
I'll clear you in. You are correct. It is basing it on IP address when it is based on clicks and opens. When it comes to tweets, it's using the Twitter geolocation.
Yep.
Yep. And Facebook was the other one. What is that using? I can't remember.
Okay. So knowing that, I would then... There's two approaches I could use. One is if you're already collecting that sort of data for existing clients, and this is a... we're going to come back to this in a minute.
Yep.
And it's okay to use the data. Right? That's a key thing, which I'll cover that in a minute. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about test data. I'm assuming that that data is already being collected. So it's not. So what I'm really looking at here is, if you, say for example, you're currently today, you're not collecting geo data.
Yeah.
And for this feature, you're going to have to do it.
Yeah.
Then obviously, you're not going to be able to just go and grab that data. You're going to have to actually somehow manufacture that data.
Sure.
So what I would want to do is come up with a test data set that has a list of known locations.
Yeah.
And so then depending on the sort of exact test case I want to run is what data I would use. Mm-hmm. So maybe I might come up with some sort of generator to based on latitude and longitude to generate that data.
Yep.
But what I'm assuming is that I would probably want to have a quick high-level thing. So take WorldView, give a set of data, and say that the first data might be, I've got 10 users, one in Sydney, one in Paris, one in London, one in Hong Kong. Boom, 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 do that and timing. So maybe it's...
Yep.
You run it for a minute, and you might stopwatch. Okay, I'm supposed to see Sydney in 10 seconds, and then...
Yeah.
And sort of somehow... And they're sort of just assuming that I can replay somehow that data. Well, it's implemented, but I can basically somehow deliver that data in a way and then have the client then sort of replay it as if in real time.
Yeah.
So we do whatever it's going to do in production, basically. So that's how I would do that at first. Then I'd want to go, all right, let's go nuts. Let's assume this is a ridiculously good campaign and throw, throw 4,000 people in Sydney, open it within 2 seconds.
Yeah.
And see that sort of scenario, what happens. Because that's, I suppose, the two main edge cases I would think of. One is the accuracy, and I don't know how accurate it needs to be with the timing. So the second one is, so it's a campaign that's just, you know, accurate. But the second one is that something's virally popular.
Yeah.
And it's going to be going on. Then obviously you get into the forwards and all the other features that the WorldView has.
Yeah.
And make sure that, again, you know, looking at Twitters and tweets, and what if I'm going to tweet where someone doesn't have geolocation on, does that even come into there at all, and those sorts of things. That's how I would test it.
So yeah.
Is that how you tested it for real, or did I get the job?
Yeah, that's pretty much it, yeah. I mean, as well as that, we took there were a few things to take into account there. There was a server-side performance, there was a client-side performance, and like you said, fire a lot of data at it at once, but there was also the matter of just seeing how it reacts to data over a long length of time, which we found some early performance issues in testing, just even on the client side with that.
Yeah, that's a really good question because I missed that. Because it's the sort of feature where you can see a marketing department going, WorldView, Plasma.
There it is. Let's leave it there overnight.
Or let's leave it there all week.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Or even I just left it there and went to lunch and then came back and then I leave my computer on all night and then I come back and... maybe it's using a gig of memory. Da, da, da. but it doesn't do that anymore.
Yeah, of course. before you shipped it. Yeah.
Of course.
But that wouldn't be your fault. That would be the browser's fault. We'd do it for not collecting properly.
We were blaming all sorts of things.
Okay. It's all standing in a circle of blame. You point to me and I point to you. And developer, you didn't fix it. Tester, you didn't find the bug. I don't know what you did. No,
Yeah, there was a third party. I don't know.
It's jQuery. jQuery. And actually, a little side note. I remember hearing a story, I don't know if it's true or not, about there was some uni students trying to solve a problem. And two of them, it was a bug in jQuery.
Yeah.
And one of them did the approach of, well, I'm not going to do anything.
Mm.
It's open source. I'll just say what the bug is and someone will fix it because it's open source.
What?
No, it's a framework. It's popular enough. If I raise the bug, someone will care enough to solve that bug.
Oh,
because it's open and widely used, I don't need to do anything because that bug will be fixed.
Oh, faith in humanity.
Right? That's what one person says. The other person went, this bug is annoying the bajoller out of me. I'm going to get in and fix this bug.
Yeah.
Because it is open source, and they contribute it back to the community.
Uh-huh.
So ironically, both students at the same university, trying to do the exact same assignment, hitting the same bug, both their approaches worked.
Yeah, that's true.
Because student A, in isolation of student B, said, no, someone will fix it, I'll just tweet about it, or I'll just raise it as a bug. Student B, who's at the same problem, is going, well, I'll fix the bug, can hit... fixed it, checked it in, and student A's got the fix.
Yeah, so the lazy developer wins off the pragmatic developer.
Well, I'd say they both won or they both lost. Anyway.
Everybody wins.
Yeah, it was an interesting little analogy. But, so jQuery, you know, whose fault is it? You know, it's the blame game. What was I trying to say? Relationships.
Yes?
Professional relationships.
Mm.
Particularly the tester developer relationship.
Oh, yes. It's tricky.
It's tricky. Some people I've seen some people who are absolutely masters.
Yeah.
Doing that. One person in mind comes out, Zuri Hilliard, she's one of the most... She's one of the few people that I've met where her background is in human resources.
Yeah.
And then she changed it to testing. So she's a master at drinking wine or having coffee or always having a ready supply of chocolate available at the desk for anyone to come and help themselves to. If you want to get people to relate to you, have a ready supply of high-quality 70% cocoa chocolate.
Yeah, the little Nintendo candies on my desk just aren't cutting it.